Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the New Yorker Iraq correspondent George Packer is back with us now. His book about the war, called The Assassin's Gate, just won an Overseas Press Club Award. He was also a finalist for a Pulitzer this year. And George Packer also has a commentary in the New Yorker's Talk of the Town section this week on a possible exit strategy for Iraq that he thinks might be a good idea, even though it's driven by what he calls the logic of desperation. So, hi, George. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be with you, Brian.
What is this exit strategy?
Well, it's not at all a new one. It's been out there on the table for several years, proposed by Leslie Gelb and by Ambassador Peter Galbraith. Basically, it's to accept the apparent reality that Iraq really can't hold together as a unified country right now in its history, and that whether or not this was inevitable, 3 years of increasingly sectarian violence has driven Iraq into three armed camps, Kurdish, Sunni, and Shiite, who really cannot coexist in a unitary central state and instead should be given autonomous regions with proportionate shares of oil wealth, which is important because the Sunnis have no oil, and there's absolutely no way they would take this deal without a guarantee of that wealth. And with a weak central government in Baghdad making foreign policy and a few other areas of governance, but basically the power would be in the regions, and the regions would go their separate ways until they decide otherwise. And the model that people like Gelb and Richard Holbrook and Joe Biden have proposed is the Dayton Accords, which divided Bosnia. There's all sorts of ways, I think, in which this is not comparable and in which this would be very hard to do. I raised it in my New Yorker comment simply to say the administration's strategy is failing, and we as a country need to be willing to talk about alternatives that are something short of precipitous withdrawal. And here's one of them, and it's serious, and it deserves to be discussed.
You call it the logic of desperation. Is this an exit strategy that you would have dismissed previously but are willing to take seriously now?
It's an exit strategy I have dismissed previously. I mean, I've written in my book that I didn't see how it could work, largely because Iraqis themselves didn't want it. I mean, you did not hear Sunnis and Shia talking about the need to have their own region and the inability to live together. They said exactly the opposite. We are all Iraqis. We've lived together for a long time. We're intermarried. It's impossible to disentangle that. And this talk of ethnic and sectarian identity was brought from the outside by you Americans. Well, that is no longer what you hear Iraqis say. When I was there in January, February, there was sharp sectarian language, and it was hateful and frightening, and they have been driven by the violence to a point where I think they're now falling back on those sectarian identities in a way that makes this proposal something that Iraqis might be more willing to look at now. But I don't think a year or two ago they would have been.
What do you think the risks of this approach would be?
I mean, they're huge. Population transfers on an enormous scale, accompanied by much greater bloodletting than we're seeing now. What would happen, for example, in the mixed cities like Mosul, Kirkuk, and especially Baghdad? There's already a kind of de facto ethnic cleansing going on in many areas around Baghdad. I think it could very likely be accelerated by this, because even if politicians sitting around a table sign their names to a deal, which is what Gelb and Biden suggest, that doesn't mean that militias and insurgents and ordinary people are going to go along with it. It's something that, while it could be achieved politically in a negotiating room, on the streets could lead to much greater violence than we're even seeing now. So that, I mean, that's a huge fear.
George Packer, New Yorker, Iraq writer, my guest on WNYC and author of The Assassin's Gate. We can take a few phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. George, you begin this article recalling a group of advisors to President Johnson during the Vietnam War, a group known then as the Wise Men. Who were the Wise Men?
They were the architects of America's early Cold War policy. They were Dean Acheson, Truman's Secretary of State, Robert Lovett, generals like Matthew Ridgway and Maxwell Taylor and Omar Bradley, McGeorge Bundy, who had been Johnson's national security advisor, had left in 66. They were a group of cold warriors, Democrats and Republicans, whose experience and insight were respected on both sides of the aisle, and above all by President Johnson, who really was willing to listen to them. And he had met with them in November of 67, and they told him, stand firm in Vietnam, you're doing the right thing. But the Tet Offensive really shook their faith in the war. And when they came back in March of 68, sort of carefully managed by Clark Clifford, who knew them all and who was now Johnson's Secretary of Defense, replacing Robert McNamara, they came into the cabinet room at the White House and told Johnson, it's not working, you can't succeed in the time you've got, it's time to start disengaging from Vietnam. And that was an enormous turning point for Johnson. I mean, it didn't happen all at once, but it was as if those who he relied on most for support had withdrawn it, and I don't think his commitment to the war was ever the same after that. And the point I make in the comment is, we don't have anyone like that. There is no group with bipartisan respect whom this president would be willing to listen to. And I think it may be a bit romantic to imagine that they were ever so wise, but it is something missing from our politics today. We don't have any kind of bipartisan or nonpartisan foreign policy thinking that anyone in power is going to listen to, and we badly need it right now.
Is it? Do we not have it because everything is so polarized around competing ideologies?
I think that's a big part of it. I think after the end of the Cold War, which was a consensus builder between Democrats and Republicans, even with all the arguments over it, foreign policy became intensely partisan. The Gingrich Congress blocked all of Clinton's foreign policy moves. 9/11 temporarily united the country, but I think President Bush, with some help from the Democrats, but largely on his own, turned it into a partisan matter pretty quickly, especially in the build-up to the war in Iraq. And now there's absolutely no common ground. And those who have tried to create common ground, such as Senators Lugar, Biden, McCain, Hillary Clinton, have really been pariahs in their own parties, rather than leaders of a consensus building effort. So there is, and those who are out of office, like the wise men of 68, well, President Bush summoned every former Secretary of State and Defense to the White House in January, and he gave them all of about 5 or 10 minutes to give him their ideas about Iraq. I mean, it was a photo op. So we're just not living in the same time, and we don't have the same kind of people around.
And I should mention that in this article, you criticize both George Bush and John Kerry for their positions on Iraq, the president for, 150 different reasons that we've spoken about 150 different times on this show, but Kerry for things that he said recently about Iraq. You want to go into that?
Well, Kerry gave a speech at Boston's Faneuil Hall a couple of weeks ago on the 35th anniversary of his congressional testimony as a Vietnam vet when he really burst onto the national scene. And by and large, I think it was a terrific speech, and it was maybe a speech he should have given in 2004 because it took the administration to task for secrecy, for torture, for violating civil liberties, for all the things that the Bush administration has done in the name of national security. And it carried a lot of weight, and it sort of harkened back to his speaking up in 71. All good. But suddenly at the end of it, he said, and therefore, we need to get out of Iraq next month, May 15th, if they have not formed a government by then, and by the end of this year, even if they do form a government. It just came out of nowhere, and it seemed ill-considered without any sort of careful weighing of what the consequences might be, what our ongoing interests in staying or leaving might be. I mean, it was just, I thought it was an irresponsible sop to those in his party who were calling for an immediate withdrawal, and it wasn't worthy of the speech that it concluded.
George Packer, author of The Assassin's Gate and staff writer on Iraq for The New Yorker, my guest on WNYC, and let's take a phone call. Stephen in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, are you there? All right, we'll give Stephen another shot in a minute. Gordon in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Gordon. Gordon, can you hear me? All right, so we're having trouble with the phones. To get back to that Kerry approach for a minute, you write that the approach could further destabilize the region with too quick a pullout, creating large safe zones for jihadis. And that, of course, is the exact reason that the U.S. went to war. So there wouldn't be safe zones around the world for Al-Qaeda camps like there were in Afghanistan before 9/11. At least supposedly that's why we went to war. So Kerry and Biden are not basically on the same page now.
Not at all. I think that in a way, the John Kerry of 1971, who famously said, how can you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake, has come back in the name of those who think that the Iraq War is an irredeemable disaster. He sees them, I think, through the same lens. And although he muted that during the campaign of 2004, I think it was there all along. Whereas Biden and others, and I have to say myself, don't see Iraq in Vietnam terms, especially over there. Maybe at home it's playing out in a similar way, but in Iraq, I mean, it is a country in a region with enormous strategic importance for us. And whatever you think of how we got there and what we're doing there, if you're going to speak publicly as a leader about it, you have to take into account the consequences for our leaving it to Shiite militias, Sunni jihadis, and predatory neighbors who will pick over the carcass of that country and extend their influence and perhaps pull it into a regional war, which I think we are now, although I don't think we're accomplishing a great deal as far as rebuilding Iraq, I do think we're preventing it from spiraling downward into that nightmare scenario. So if you're going to call for withdrawal, I think you have to make an argument why we can live with that, why we can live with an Iraq that's torn apart in this very sensitive and volatile region with neighboring countries eyeing it hungrily.
Let's try a call again. Stephen in Jersey City, I think we've got you now. Stephen?
Yeah, you got me now.
Hi.
Hi, I just want to start off by thanking George. I think your pieces are incredible, very enlightening, so I'd like to thank you for that. Also, you really just touched on it now. I'm calling because I think a lot of people are getting the mistaken impression that there won't be serious consequences if we withdraw, because you hear people like Jack Murtha, John Kerry, and people are really getting the impression that this is kind of like Vietnam, where the domino theory proved unfounded, Chinese dominance never, you know, spread because Vietnam and China went to war. But, you know, the strategic implications of a pullout are just, would be this absolute disaster. And I was just wondering, you know, how do you think, you know, you can spread the message, you know, of the complications, really?
Well, I completely agree with you, and you put it extremely well, that Vietnam, in a sense, was one we could get away with. We could go home and be allowed to lick our wounds without being troubled by that region further, but that's not going to be the case here. You know, what concerns me, Stephen, is that we're in a deadlock right now. We're sort of politically paralyzed between a stubborn administration that insists on pursuing what I think is a policy very unlikely to succeed, namely that a government of national unity is going to be able to suppress the insurgency, and an opposition that is either quiet or is simply saying, as Kerry did, get out. And I don't know what to say other than that we have to simply continue to have conversations like this. Congressmen need to be pressured to hold hearings and to talk about it in a grown-up way. All along, we have failed as a country to have a serious discussion about this war, and I think that begins with Congress and it includes the press, but it also includes the citizenry. Actually, I've noticed that there's an Iraq veteran, Paul Rykoff, who's got a book out, who's going around now talking about just these things, and it's extremely heartening to hear him talk, and maybe other veterans will get into the conversation. But
and here's an example of the breakdown of trust in the administration and maybe in the discourse. Here's a clip of former CIA analyst Ray McGovern kind of heckling Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld when Rumsfeld spoke yesterday at the Southern Center for International Studies. Listen.
I'd just like an honest answer.
I'm giving it to you.
We're talking about lies and your allegation that there was bulletproof evidence of ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. Was that a lie, or were you misled?
Zarqawi was in Baghdad during the pre-war period. That is a fact.
He was in the north of Iraq in a place where Saddam Hussein had no rule.
He was also in Baghdad.
Yeah, when he needed to go to the hospital.
So, George Packer, what do you make of that?
Brian, it just depresses me, and the reason is, I think essentially the ex-CIA guy is right, but we are doomed to keep rehearsing those weeks and months before the war. We're like a neurotic patient that cannot escape some past trauma, whereas we are confronted now in the present with a very serious question about how we're going to get through and out of this, and instead we keep going back to that. And obviously there are reasons. It's because we didn't have an open and honest discussion at the time, but this is urgent, and it's interesting and representative that is the kind of discussion that we just heard that is going on now, not the one about what we're doing now and what we should do.
We're almost out of time. There was a political breakthrough in Iraq last week. After months of failure to form a government after the elections, they finally picked a compromise candidate for Prime Minister Nouri Kamal al-Maliki. Do you think he has the potential to unite Iraq in a meaningful way that could really change the nature of the situation there for the United States? We have 30 seconds.
It's just a hope. I mean, he's all we've got, and Condoleezza Rice is pinning all of her hopes on him. The government is pinning all of their hopes, which shows how improbable the strategy is. He's a Shiite hardliner, a number two in a Iran-backed party. The thought that he's going to emerge as a kind of Nelson Mandela of Iraq seems like a real long shot, but because of their strategy, he's all we've got, and so we can only hope that he will.
George Packer, New Yorker correspondent who writes frequently about Iraq. His book, The Assassin's Gate, was just awarded an Overseas Press Club Award. George, always so enlightening. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
Mm-hmm.